Welcome to In the Weeds with Nicole Asquith, exploring the way culture shapes our relationship to the natural world. When I was growing up, my parents had the same debate about the Christmas tree every year. Large and full, my dad, versus what my mom wanted, the kind with stronger, evenly spaced branches that allow room for the ornaments to dangle. My mom usually won. This seemed a bit ridiculous to me as a child, though predictably I now find myself lobbying for the same kind of tree my mom wanted. And I now understand why she liked that kind of tree. My mother had a somewhat itinerant childhood in Europe and ended up in the Swiss-German part of Switzerland, where Christmas trees were still lit with real candles, hence the spaced-out branches. I remember these candle-lit trees from my early childhood, also spent in Switzerland. They were exceptionally beautiful. And yes, dangerous. My grandmother's neighbor's house burned down from a Christmas tree left unattended a little too long. The Christmas tree is still my favorite part of Christmas. It brings back those deep-rooted memories, like the time my father drove us out to the forest in Alsace, the part of France, formerly at times part of Germany, that my grandfather came from. I remember pulling over to the side of the road, walking into the forest, and just cutting down a tree. I'm guessing that wasn't exactly legal, and it's certainly not something you should do. Still, it left its mark on me. It means that for me, the Christmas tree is always the incarnation of the forest, bringing its kindled magic into our home in the dark days of winter. A couple of years ago, before I started this podcast, I decided to look into the history of the Christmas tree. I had been learning about trees, those fascinating creatures that, thanks to the work of people like Suzanne Simard and Peter Volleben, we're getting to know better. And I was struck by the simple fact of bringing a tree indoors. What had started this tradition and what was at stake in the gesture, I wondered. So I did a little dive into the history and was tickled to find out that the earliest historical record of a tree brought indoors and decorated for Christmas was in Alsace. In 1604, a citizen of Strasbourg wrote, "On Christmas they put fir trees in the rooms in Strasbourg. They hang red roses cut from many colored paper, apples, offerings, gold tinsel, sugar." In Celestat, a town in the south of Alsace, there's an inscription from 1521 about the guards who had to keep an eye on the local forest where people would cut down trees. Another document from 1611 in Turkheim sets the fine for anyone caught taking trees. I guess thieves, such as my father and I, were an issue from early on. But to get the real story, I had to reach out to a historian. I was lucky enough to speak via the wonders of the internet with Judith Flanders, a historian who has written numerous books on the Victorian period, including The Invention of Murder, How the Victorians Reveled in Death and Detection and Created Modern Crime, and The Victorian City, Everyday Life in Dickens' London. In her book from 2017, Christmas, A Biography, Flanders separates the many myths about Christmas from what we actually know from the historical record.
Most Christmas stories, you could add, is simply not true at the end. You know, Santa's red suit comes from Coca-Cola, or Prince Albert invented the Christmas tree.
Though she debunks many of the myths, the true story is equally riveting. To set the stage, she and I started talking about the origins of the holiday itself, which were not, strictly speaking, religious. As she puts it,
there has very rarely been any Christ in Christmas.
Early Christians were not particularly interested in the birth of Jesus. So I asked her, how did it come about?
Basically, Christmas is, if not a latecomer to religious observance, certainly not something that is built in to the beginning of the Christian religion. It's the 4th century before the church officially designates the 25th of December as the birth date of Christ to be celebrated as a church liturgical holiday. So there's no real core reason for it to be the 25th of December. We don't know why the church chose that day. There is nothing in the Gospels that suggest any particular date at all. And even from the beginning, from that 4th century origination of Christmas as a church holiday. People were generally clearly considering it to be more of, as it has always been throughout its history, a festive, oh hell, it's dark outside, we have all this food and drink stored up from the harvest, it's a quiet agricultural season, so now is our time to party. From the very beginning, about 30 years after we know the first celebration of Christmas took place, there is already records of an archbishop castigating his flock for focusing far too much on the feasting and the dancing.
Right. So this idea, you know, you see sometimes today you'll see signs saying things like keep Christ in Christmas, or there's this anxiety about the commercialization of Christmas. But you suggest that that tension has been there pretty much from the inception.
My suggestion is there has very rarely been any Christ in Christmas. This is really one of the there are two things about Christmas that are true. One is that almost any story you are told is a lie that has been fabricated after the event. And second of all, that anyone at any period of time will look at their Christmas and tell you that Christmas was better before.
Right.
The earliest record I have found, I can't remember the precise date, I think it's 1612. Was the earliest date I found for someone writing that, oh God, Christmas was better in the old days. This is an absolute standard line throughout history.
So what about the idea that the date coincides with the winter solstice and also with the celebration of the god of the sun in ancient Roman times?
There is something to that. The choice of December the 25th does seem to be tied into the winter solstice, the shortest day of the year. When the Julian calendar was adopted in 45 BCE, the 25th of December was the shortest day of the year. Because originally the leap year was not calculated in, as we know, the actual length of the year is 365 days and a quarter. And because of this miscalculation of the missing quarter of a day, what happened was that gradually Easter, which is calculated from the spring equinox, became hugely out of whack and had to be brought back for the church to be able to mark it properly. In bringing the spring equinox from the 25th to the 21st of March, they sort of inadvertently moved the winter solstice from the 25th to the 21st of December. And that is how they split apart. The choice was very clearly to put Christmas on the shortest day of the year. However, with this, I will add that there is absolutely no evidence that has survived of any winter solstice celebrations from pagan Europe. There may have been, there may not have been. We simply have no idea. So anyone who tells you, oh, you know, this is a pagan remnant, that is a pagan remnant, they're talking through their hat. We just don't know. What we do know is that there were Roman festivals at this time of year. There was Saturnalia, when religious offerings were made to the god of agriculture, which began on the 17th of December and lasted for a week. And it will sound familiar. The shops were closed. You didn't go to work. You gave each other gifts and you ate and you drank and you gambled. This was followed by a holiday called the Calends, with a K, which was a New Year's Eve festival. It ran officially from the 1st of January to the 3rd of January, but unofficially it too lasted about 5 days. It too will sound familiar. Buildings were decorated with greenery, and people ate and drank and watched processions and gave each other small gifts. And then between those two holidays, came the celebration of the solstice. By the first century, Mithraism, the worship of Mithras, had spread from the Middle East to become one of the most widely practiced religions in the Roman Empire. Like paganism, we know very little about it. Most of what we know is a guess, but we are under the impression that it's something to do, the main element is something to do with slaying a sacred bull that probably happened in the spring. It's probably a fertility thing, and we don't really know. The birth of Mithras, however, was marked at the winter solstice, the birthday of, as he was called, the unconquered sun. And Mithras emerges from his birthplace in a cave, witnessed by two shepherds. And so, as you can see from those three holidays I've told you about, elements of all three accreted to what became the Christmas holiday.
Right. So, given that Christmas becomes December 25th, which was the winter solstice, and given that it's the darkest time of the year, greenery seems to be one thing that is part of this amalgam, right? And you said during the Roman holiday of Calends, they would decorate with greenery.
That's correct. So greenery is part of the holiday, and it stays a part of the holiday, although it is worth noting that at the same time, certainly in the British Isles and many of the Christmas customs we know of, greenery was also an element in the British Isles, in Northern Europe more generally, of midsummer holidays too. Mm-hmm. Greenery is just a holiday tradition.
So you think perhaps that's just because it's festive?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's festive, yeah. And it's there.
Right. And of course, but in the wintertime, you're likely turning towards evergreens of some form or another, right?
In Northern Europe,
yeah, of course.
Right. And that is essentially where the bulk of the Christmas traditions grew out of, is the Northern European tradition. The main element of the Christmas tree, however, we know quite specifically where this came from. There is the greenery element, which has been the case for holidays more generally over the centuries. And then for the Christmas period, in the Middle Ages, in Germany in particular, or what is today Germany, the 24th of December in the Christian Church is the feast day of Adam and Eve. And in the Middle Ages, there grew up for a period a tradition of outdoor plays that were performed on the feast day of Adam and Eve, retelling the story of the expulsion from the Garden of Eden. And of course, if you are retelling the story of the Garden of Eden, you need a tree of knowledge. In Germany, in the winter, your green tree is going to, by definition, be an evergreen because you don't have much choice. To recreate the tree of knowledge for what were called paradise plays, they strung up apples on the evergreen trees so that Adam could eat from the tree of knowledge. The paradise plays eventually went out of fashion. But having these trees decorated with fruits and later Bible verses or paper flowers or gilded sweets did not go out of fashion. Instead, what happened was these trees, which were erected outside, gradually moved indoors.
I find it striking that there's this connection between the tree of knowledge and the Christmas tree. Do you make anything of that sort of symbolically?
No.
Do you, no, it's just a historical coincidence.
I think that this is simply, you know, the winter season in the agricultural year is a season of quiet in the sense that there isn't much to do agriculturally. you have had your winter harvest, you have slaughtered all the animals that you are not going to overwinter. So you've got a lot of meat, you have a lot of stored fruit and vegetables, you have made your beer for the year, you have harvested the grapes for the wine, depending on whether you live in the north or the south. And therefore, with nothing else to do, this is your season to eat and drink.
It's time to party.
To party, exactly. So I think that all that we've got is we've got people with time on their hands in, let's face it, agricultural, pre-industrial, a very hard life. You take what pleasures you can when you can. And if you've got this pretty decorated tree with some apples on it, well, hey, great.
So the first decorated indoor tree that we know about was in Strasbourg, right, in 1605.
This is correct. This is the one that we know about. We know that there were outdoor trees throughout the 16th century, and they were mostly public trees. So they were put out up outside guilds or town halls, places like that. And then from the 1530s, we know that Strasbourg markets were selling trees for people to have indoors, but we do not actually have any reports of them. We know that they were going, but we don't have any reports of people seeing them. So the first report of a decorated tree that we know of, as opposed to just putting up a pine tree, is 1605. And we are told that it had paper roses, it had apples, it had wafers, which are little wax discs, sweets, candy, which had gilt on them, and sugar ornaments.
Not that different from today's Christmas tree in a way.
No, I mean, more edible.
Right.
As we're used to, as Americans, you know, learn about Christmas trees in areas with German immigration in the States, you're often told that they have cookies and sweets on them, candies. This is a very solid German tradition.
Right. One of the things you write about that I thought was interesting is you said there were different names for Christmas trees in a Protestant tradition than in a Catholic tradition. So it's a Weihnachtsbaum or a Tannenbaum if you're a Protestant. It's a Lebensbaum or Lichterbaum if you're Catholic. So I have a couple of questions. One was, I couldn't quite tell from reading you if it emerges as more of a Protestant tradition first, or if that's not the case, and, you know, if there's some kind of bifurcation there.
There does seem to be some bifurcation, but gradually, I mean, I think they were in general originally probably slightly more prevalent in the Protestant areas. But basically what happened is people just liked them. And so they lost the sect reading and they just became Weihnachtsbaum, Christmas trees. That they stopped having overtones of Protestant or Catholic fairly early on.
Okay. So it's a common assumption that Prince Albert introduced the Christmas tree to England, but you point out that it had already arrived towards the end of the 18th century. Is that correct?
That is correct. This is one of the many things about Christmas that is simply not true. Most Christmas stories, you could add, is simply not true at the end. You know, Santa's red suit comes from Coca-Cola, or Prince Albert invented the Christmas tree, or all of these things are not true. Anything that is too good to be true is.
Although some of the real stories are equally surprising. So, for instance, Christmas trees used to sometimes be suspended upside down. Is that right?
So I understand. I have sadly never seen a picture of one. I would like to, but that is my understanding, that you bought what was called, this was a German custom, what was called a pine top. So I assume it's much smaller than a full tree, although how much is a top, I don't know. And instead of sort of planting it tree side up the way we would expect, the trunk was suspended and it hung point side down and then you decorated. And I suppose when you think about it, if you are hanging fruit and things from it, it probably works quite nicely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I suppose that's true. So I'm sorry. So I interrupted you though. So you were going to explain how it actually came to England.
Well, what happened was, we don't know how it came to England. England had a fairly good-sized German community, mostly merchants. And there are, in the late 18th century, there is the occasional mention of them having trees. So we do know that there were trees in the late 18th century, but again, nothing very specific. In the 1780s, a very famous German novel called The Sorrows of Young Werther by Goethe was translated into English. And it was a huge success. I mean, it was an insane success. Young men who wanted to be in the fashion wore clothes of the type described that the hero wore in the book. There were Werther jackets and Werther boots. You know, it became a thing. So one of the scenes in the book is set on a Christmas Eve. And so you have this German Christmas tree, which in the German fashion had candles in it. So because of the huge popularity of this book, there was the beginnings of knowledge that this was a German custom. And at this stage in British history, first of all, as you're probably aware, in the 18th century in Britain, the British royal family is German.
Right.
George I is the Elector of Hanover. He is German. He does not speak English.
Fascinating.
Yeah. Well, Americans sort of tend not to know that. But it is an entirely German royal family. By the end of the 18th century, you're talking about his son, grandson, great-grandson. You know, they have, so to speak, been naturalized. But the wife of George III is Queen Charlotte. She is German-born. And we have a record in 1789 that the husband of one of her ladies-in-waiting suggests putting up what she writes is an illuminated tree according to the German fashion. She, on the other hand, is a bit doubtful. She says, I thought our children too young to be amused at so much expense and trouble. And besides, all their friends were away, so no one would see it. So we have, very interestingly, a whole lot of assumptions there. First of all, that there are people put up trees, that they are mostly for the children, that they're expensive and troublesome, all things that people have been saying for the last couple of hundred years. So anyway, they, as far as we know, they don't end up doing that. In 1800, it is recorded that Queen Charlotte at Windsor Castle puts up a tree. So as far as we know, that's the first indoor decorated tree in Britain.
Okay.
And that is, I'm not going to get this date right, it's nearly four decades before Prince Albert, also, of course, German, comes to marry Queen Victoria.
Right. And then has this famous image. Right. Well,
the reason we are under the impression, or that people are under the impression, that Prince Albert brings the Christmas tree from Germany to Britain is that in 1848, a magazine carried an engraving of Queen Victoria and Prince Albert and their children at Windsor with their Christmas tree. And this image became hugely famous. And indeed, an American magazine didn't quite reprint the image. What they did was they removed Queen Victoria's jewelry and Prince Albert's sort of medal and his sash. And rather weirdly, also, I noticed his mustache. I couldn't quite work that one out. and reprinted it, just calling it something like A Christmas at Home. I can't remember what the caption was. So what they did was they said this wasn't something royalty did. This was something people did.
Mm-hmm. And based on what you wrote, I understand that Christmas trees had arrived in North America fairly early as well.
Christmas trees arrived in North America before they arrived in Britain, to the best of our knowledge, because the colonies had such big German populations.
Oh, right.
We don't know when they first arrived, but we do know that particularly the Moravian communities who had arrived in Pennsylvania, at least in the 1740s, rather the way the Germans had several centuries before had paradise plays, the Moravian Brethren in Pennsylvania put what they call pyramids of greenery. So we're not sure whether they actually were trees or whether they were branches shaped into pyramids. And then they had, I'm sorry, I can't remember what you call them in the States. We call them creches here. Sort of little nativity
scene. Right, like a manger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A nativity scene or a creche.
Right.
In front of it.
Mm. If you're interested in other aspects of the history of Christmas, I highly recommend Judith Flanders' book. Although I didn't include it in this episode, we also talked a bit about the origin of Santa Claus, which she believes was not, in fact, from the Dutch settlers in New York, as Washington Irving would lead us to believe, but might have been a derivation of the Swiss tradition of Sammy Claus, who arrives with treats with his alter ego, Schmutzli, on December 6th, St. Nicholas Day, a holiday my mother remembers and that she always honored because it's also my name day. Though Flanders, to her credit, does not err outside the bright lines of the historical record, I don't think it's a stretch to imagine that the tradition of the Christmas tree, and more broadly of bringing greenery into the home in the dead of winter, spoke to the promise of renewed life in the natural world. I have read elsewhere that in Alsace and other parts of Europe, people cut branches from fruiting trees, cherry, plum, and apple, in early December and put them in vases to force them to flower, and that if they flowered by Christmas time, it promised a good harvest. We know, at any rate, that plant life coming back in the spring was essential to survival in pre-industrial Europe. Similarly, evergreens, even today, bring life and warmth at a time when the world is otherwise sparse and bare. I like to think of this tradition as a nod to the renewal of life that comes after the solstice, that ensures the bond between human and non-human life. I'm going to take a little break over the holidays, so the next episode will likely not come out until the new year. I'm looking forward to it, though. I'll be talking to one of my favorite guests, the geologist Marcia Bjornrud, about how to read rocks. Every day, my dog Coco and I take a hike in the woods, and I wanted to know more about the rocks I encounter. A lot of them glacial erratic, that is, rocks left in the wake of the melting glacier about 18,000 years ago. In the meantime, happy holidays. Thank you to my husband, Dave Larzelier, for recording his version of O Tannenbaum, and to my friend Sonia Fujimori, who inspired me by recording her outing with her family to upstate New York to cut down their Christmas tree.
Okay, so who's going to saw first, Daddy?
I'm not sawing. Oh, I'm not sawing.
Oh, we should take turns, because it's a hard job, so.
I'm not sawing. Oh, I'll carry it. I'm not sawing. I'm just going
to carry it. I want to carry it.
And I think